want to say a few words about psychogeography, which is a motivating spirit in some sense behind the series of concerts we've been performing in Scotland and Newcastle. Lately, psychogeography has become a code word for something like keen observation and unburied histories, especially of feminist or labor or gender variety. And I think it's terrific. I think the kind of stuff that is being done under that aegis is valuable and useful. But I want to suggest that psychogeography used to be something a little different from what it's turned into, and that what it used to be has something useful to suggest about what it could be. I think it could be a lot more than it is, or a lot more useful than it is. Psychogeography was coined as a word in any of its current senses in the early 50s by Guy Debord, who at the time was a lettrist. The lettrists were a fragment of the Parisian avant-garde following World War II, that emerged following World War II, and that somehow worked themselves out of dissolving surrealism. Guy Debord was extremely interested from the very beginning in the relationship between people and their environment. And I think that it's not too much to say that he was enraged by what was happening to the Paris that he loved. And I should say that was happening particularly to the Paris that he loved. The Paris that he didn't love, he didn't really care that much about, but coincidentally, it wasn't the Paris that anything much was happening to. The sort of thing that got him can be exemplified just by looking at this space right outside behind you. In fact, he uses an illustration of a space very, very similar to this in one of his early publications to suggest the kind of horror that was occurring in the city that he had found, at least in places, to be essentially human. This wasn't. Whatever's going on in the space that we're in now, as interesting as it may be at the moment, is frankly a mark of such design irresponsibility, it's almost hard to talk about it. And in his anger, he started thinking about a way that we could objectify the sorts of things that he liked about Paris and the sorts of things about Paris that he responded to really strongly, that he sort of caught together under the term unities of ambience. These unities of ambience were places that were powerfully attractive. They were imbued with this powerful, attractive force that would literally pull you into them if you let yourself be pulled into them, if you didn't force yourself to go off on some other kind of agenda. And to discover these spaces, you had to do a couple of things. And these he wrapped together under the name drift, or dérive, which has become a very popular sort of pastime today. But for him, was anything but a pastime. It was an extremely serious activity. The drift was a way of letting yourself go. You literally approached the city with no agenda and no intention whatsoever, which is a lot harder to do than it sounds, which was one of the problems right off the bat. And in this condition of agendalessness, when you started walking, the parts of the city that were powerfully attractive would pull you into them, and the parts of the city that were repulsive would push you away. And so all you had to do was let yourself go and just move, and the city would naturally pull you across this terrain of passion that he was able to identify and ultimately map. Another thing that was important to him was that this be an objective measure. He wasn't really interested in subjectivities of any kind. And to make sure it was objective, he insisted you had to drift in groups. Not huge groups. This would be way, way, way too big to drift. But 3, 4, 5, maybe as many as 10 people, sort of like-minded people, and you would meet and you would vacate yourself of agendas and intentions, and you just drift. And because you were doing it together, the synchrony among you as you moved or were pulled through these spaces would guarantee the objectivity of the outcome. He mapped these in a couple of very famous and increasingly influential maps. Discourse of the Passion of Love he did in 56, and in 57 with Asger Jorn he did another map, The Naked City. And these maps consist of fragments of ordinary street maps. And these fragments are these unities of ambience. And he's put them down on paper. He's connected them with red arrows. the red arrows represent the force that pulls you or pushes you from place to place. And you can, there's some places that are like act like turntables where you can, you enter them and you don't have to just be pulled off in one direction. You have the possibility of being pulled off in several. And so you literally, this is a map of the Paris that's desirable, a desire map of Paris, as it were. This effort, in fact, the whole situationist effort, because by the time he started doing these maps, he'd become a situationist, or it transformed his Lettrist International into the Situationist International. This was a fragmentary effort. This was a fugitive effort. There were never a lot of situationists, even if you count the situationists in all the different parts of the world where there were situationists, probably, 100? There's an online catalog that you can go to, and you can see everybody who could be identified as situationist, and the most capacious I've seen has 250 people in it. And that's really, there were handfuls of them. And after 68, May 68, they were extremely involved in Paris in May 68. In the early 70s, situationism, you must never say situationism. There was no situationism. The Situationist International dissolved and came to a conclusion. And that was that. Everybody forgot about it. Until the 90s. And in the 90s, thanks to translations and the growing importance of his book, The Society of the Spectacle, Guy Debord's work began to be recovered and became increasingly influential, and today is responsible for lots and lots and lots of people all over the world going on drifts all the time. Okay, that's one important moment that I want to talk about, an early moment in the history of psychogeography. Another materialized in Massachusetts. In the same time that Debord was engaged in the same activities, was brought into being by a planner, an MIT planner named Kevin Lynch. He was a professional academic at an engineering school, and it was about as far removed from a situationist ethos as you could possibly imagine. And yet he too was dismayed by what planning in the 50s was doing to the city that he loved, in this case Boston, and he became concerned to figure out how he could do something about it. And he didn't do the same thing, but he did something somewhat similar. He was really concerned to understand how ordinary people perceived and moved about their cities. And he didn't drift as an academic. He went out with questionnaires and asked people questions and had them draw sketch maps and took them on walking tours and recorded their descriptions of their trip. In fact, those might be the first recordings. They were done in the late 50s. The first recordings of people's descriptions of just moving through the city and their responses to them. He produced in 1960 a book, The Image of the City, which came along with maps. Maps as erratic in their power as Guy Debord's, and a lot more widely known. The Image of the City, which is the book, has been in continuous print since 1960. That's quite a run for an academic book that one would imagine on the face of it would be read by relatively small numbers of people. A lot of people thought all of a sudden that utilizing these Lynchian techniques, it was somehow like we could just slice your head open and look down and would see the map of your city in your head. And then people went out in large numbers and carried out Lynchian-type work, mostly carried out by his students, but he had a large number of students, and they occupied important positions in planning departments, not only in the United States, but elsewhere in the world. It's another psychogeography that came into being when David Stay, who was strongly influenced by Kevin Lynch, who was a psychologist, came to Clark University as a member of the geography department and taught a course originally in human-environment interactions that soon became called by students and was then officially called psychogeography. And Stay in psychogeography, which basically consumed Lynch's work and tried to expand it, was the foundation for a 5, maybe 7-year run of psychogeography among geographers. A lot of work was done at this time. David Stay and I wrote a cognitive atlas, psychological explorations of four Mexican cities, for example. And David Stay was supplemented by another psychologist on the geography faculty, Robert J. Beck, with whom I wrote a book called Home Rules. Many other really important works in what would become environmental psychology were produced at this time. And in fact, these people would go on and found or head environmental psychology programs elsewhere in the United States. Again, psychogeography as such sort of withered and disappeared. Not to return in any important way until with the rediscovery of Debordian psychogeography, psychogeography became current again. And once again, there's a growing interest in the work of the psychogeographers in eastern Massachusetts in the 60s, in the early 70s. I think what's really critical about both of these psychogeographies is that they wanted to use people to measure the environment. They didn't want to use maps, they didn't want to use tape measures, they didn't want to use clocks, they didn't want to use timers. They wanted to use people. And on that note, we're going to go on to our next site, where I'll have a few other words to say about shadowed spaces.
It's up the stairs. Follow that man there with a ladder technique.